Leslie Odom Jr. is here. Welcome, sir.
Daoud, thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Talk to me about singing for the theater, because Hamilton has reminded me that it's a really specific skill. And you're a recording artist as well. You put a solo album out, was it last year?
Yeah.
So in a song like Wait For It, or a song like The Room Where It Happens, these gigantic numbers, what is it that you found that Broadway demands of you as a singer?
I think everything about the theater is about extremes. I mean, that it's turned the volume up emotionally.
Uh-huh.
Every night that I show up at the Rogers, there's a demand for a range of expressiveness that, you know, at a cabaret show that I do is not necessarily, it's not demanded in the same way.
Do you need an audience to like you in theater?
Absolutely not. God, no.
Yeah.
You need them to either love you or hate you.
Mm-hmm.
Ambivalence is death in the theater. I mean, you know, I won't say the name of the show, but the worst show I've ever seen in New York, I went to see twice because it was so bad.
Really?
I hated it so much.
That you wanted to learn why it was so bad?
Well, when a friend of mine said they hadn't seen it, I was like, well, I have to take you. You're going to hate this thing so much. That, to me, is more interesting than just the thing that I walked out of the theater and was like, God, what a waste of 2 hours.
Right.
Right? So it's about polarization. You know, you're trying to stir up something in your audience.
Well, the way that that manifests in Hamilton, could I get you to sing one line, or is that a no-no?
No, sure.
So this is in the Act One finale. The Revolutionary War is over. Hamilton comes to Burr. He says, Burr, I'm working on this thing, the Federalist Papers. Burr is not having it, doesn't want anything to do with Hamilton's controversial ideas. And so Hamilton challenges him, and he says, for once in your life, take a stand with pride. I don't understand how you stand to the side.
I'll keep all my plans close to my chest. Wait for it. I'll wait here and see which way the wind will blow. I'm taking my time watching the afterbirth of a nation, watching the tension grow. Knock, knock, knock. I'm not warmed up. That was probably terrible and out of key.
No, you're fine. That moment is kind of incredible to me, because all through that conversation, you've been trying to keep your cool. You've been trying to be dispassionate, speaking on beat, but not really engaging with the beat. And then it takes just the right provocation. And suddenly there is this operatic declaration. The whole timbre of your voice changes. And by the end of that phrase, you're sort of back in storyteller mode. You're not just talking about you. You're talking about the beginning of this country and all of the uncertainty that goes along with it. How does that happen? I mean, how do those decisions get made about what you're going to do with your voice in a moment like that?
Daoud, what a fantastic and complicated question. And I can answer it in a really simple way. It was of the utmost importance that I was not you during this process, that I did not ask the same questions that you ask or analyze it in the way that you analyze it. I believe that when art is done in its highest form, most of the good stuff is happening subconsciously. There are things that happen consciously for sure. And, you know, I come from a conservatory background. I come from the conservatory training.
You went to Carnegie Mellon?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes about a decade to let all of that stuff go and to go to get back to your belly, you know, to get back to your instincts. Because when you come out of school, and I graduated with honors, you know, I was a good student. I was a good boy. And I got A's and I, you know, did all the papers right. And that's not what you want to see as an audience member. You do not want to see somebody that's up there trying to do it right,
uh-huh.
trying to do it perfectly. And
uh-huh.
so I'll say about that moment, in the same way that it was my job to discover the breadcrumbs that Lynn had left along the way, I hopefully illuminated things for him that he didn't know he'd done.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Lynn, did you realize that this thing is just like this thing you
uh-huh.
wrote? And this melody kind of repeats itself, but if I sing it a little differently, it'll, you know, you're illuminating. You are telling me things about the performance that I didn't realize. What I after I'd done all the research about Burr and I'd learned what Lynn had written and what they decided with the orchestrations, then my job is to not judge myself and get beyond any fear that I have or any trepidation that I have about doing something weird or are they going to like it, you know, and just to go from my belly. The recording, I'm going off on a tangent, but the recording of the album was like that.
Yeah.
Because I could not go in there. It would not, it just wouldn't serve the material or anybody if I went in there and sang something the way that I'd planned it. What I tried to do on the day that we recorded the album, this thing that's going to be there forever, is, well, this is how I'm responding to the material today.
Yeah. Do you reach for something personal in those moments? Because Lin-Manuel Miranda is the only person in Hamilton who is singing his own words.
Yeah.
You were on Charlie Rose this summer, and one of the first things that you talked about was watching Def Poetry Jam.
Yeah.
As a, what, a teenager?
Yeah, I was like 17, 18.
And you talked about in that moment, the thing that was so compelling to you was that they seemed to need to communicate. You said they need you to get it. You said there's blood in the pen.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time that you felt that way, that entertainment was something more than just being entertained?
Well, it didn't really... for a long time, I think I spent most of my childhood and my early years as a performer in student mode. And I think that's okay. I mean, it led me to where I am. I have a great foundation, a great training foundation, but it took me a long time to let the training go.
What does that mean, let the training go?
Well, because in material like this, I hope that there is a danger in what we're doing. I hope that we are on a razor's edge. You know, one of the best compliments that we got, one of our dressers, Jeannie, when her husband came, she said he spent the whole car ride home talking about how dangerous the show was. He said, there's a point where Anthony throws a chair across the stage, and he said, do you realize, like, if that guy didn't catch the chair, like, somebody could die in the audience, somebody could get hurt. And that is, you know, again, the biggest drag in the theater for me is if I go see an evening of theater and there's not one surprise, there's not one moment that takes my breath away or makes me, you know, if it plots along and everything goes the way I know that it's going to go. So it was late that I realized, you know, that I needed to let the training go. And what happened was I was out in L.A. doing a lot of TV and booking work, you know, working pretty consistently because I knew how to sort of call upon a thing and do it right. Mm-hmm. And so that could get you jobs. Mm-hmm. But I got very sad because one day I realized that other people's work was inspiring me and my own was not. I wasn't doing the kind of work that I loved to see other people do. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest things that Lynn offered me with this show was the chance to be the artist that I've always loved. You know, kind of the thing in hip hop is you have to write your own rhymes.
Right.
Right. So in this situation, I wasn't going to have the opportunity to have written the words. So the very most that I could do was connect this thing to my instincts. I didn't know if I would succeed, but I knew that I had the opportunity to become the kind of artist that had always inspired me. Mm-hmm. And that is just somebody who is raw and honest and vulnerable and scary. You know, I mean, those are my favorite kind of artists. You know, when I go see a concert and I feel like I'm seeing something that is happening for the first and maybe the last time. They might not have any more left to do tomorrow.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was somewhere in my 20s I realized that that's what my job was and that I needed to figure out, I really needed to figure out how to get there.
This speaks to me to the collaborative nature of theater, and it's actually an interesting counterpart to hip-hop, because hip-hop in its beginnings was inherently a live medium and there was a strong group ethic to it. And now, like, you know, basically any kind of popular music, you can make it in your room, you can distribute it from your bedroom, you can do all of these things without ever having to talk to another person. And theater is really resolutely not like that. I mean, if it's just one person throwing a chair, and there's nobody there to catch it, then, you know, there's nothing to it. So that it seems like that danger aspect is also based in trust, the trust that, that people working in theater have to have in one another.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, from its creation, you know, theater is the point is catharsis. Mm-hmm. The point is, you know, for us to all gather in the square together and laugh together and cry together and feel whatever spontaneous emotion erupts from us as a group. That is the point of it. The construct of our society is just that we, you know, all of us, we have to show up to work and be these good boys and good girls, and we play by the rules and all this stuff. Theater is the place where I don't want to see you play by the rules. Yeah. I don't. That's what we do all day. What we come here for is to see you throw a chair at somebody. I want to see you break the dishes. I want. That's why I come here. And so, you know, in that way, it feels very close to the way I grew up in church, you know, which that church was the place. We didn't go to see theater growing up. And church in its own way, you know, had a degree of theater to it. I mean, you know, there was a message that was prepared that was going to be spoken aloud. There's music and dance sometimes, and, you know, there's ritual. And so,
and you have to see those people again. It's not like being a touring artist where it's just like, that was a terrible show, but
it's like
who
a
knows
repertoire
if I'll ever
company.
See those
Look
people again.
Yeah, that's a good, that's right. a good point. But yeah, it's true. It's the same community getting up each week and doing this thing for the, and it's the same need. It's worship. It is catharsis. It's ministry. And so when I'm doing my job right at the Rogers, it feels very close to that. It feels like, I think to get back to your other question, it feels like I am a conduit for whatever Lynn's messages were, and messages might be the wrong word, but whatever Lynn's intentions were about community and about what he has to say about, you know, whose country this belongs to, right? I'm a conduit for that message. And then I'm also there to usher these people in to their catharsis, to usher them closer to whatever they need to feel for that day. Yeah. And, you know, that's all of our jobs, but as the narrator, as the guide for the audience, you know, I take that part of my job very seriously.
Does it have an effect on you over time? Like, I've seen you say, and some of your fellow cast members say, that, you know, this is a cast where the principals are almost all people of color, and being in the show feels like the first time that you have felt like a part of this early American history.
Yeah.
What does performance do in that sense, or the arts in general do, that traditional education can't impress upon you?
I think it's empathy. I think it is literally stepping in somebody else's shoes for a couple hours and walking around in them and seeing how it might have felt to be them, how it might have, you know, it's playing pretend. And then what happens is the same thing happens for the audience. They're watching people that look like them, or, you know, that they connect to, and it's me, or it's Lynn, or it's David, or it's Renee. You know, they have to take your pick, Philippa. And they are able to, you know, feel what that person is feeling. And you know, and empathy is just, it's the first step in bringing two people from opposite sides of the table a little closer to each other. So it does, the show has made me a better friend, a better husband, a better, you know, artist. It started a tremendous amount of growth in me as a person. And that was another reason why I had to stay a part of it, because I could see those seeds flowering right from like the first reading that I did, you know, and so it was just, I mean, how do you walk away from that? Just, where am I gonna go?
Yeah.
I mean, this thing is making me a better me.
I mean, I know you saw an early version of the show before you were in the show.
Yeah.
And you saw the guy playing Aaron Burr.
Yeah.
Did you envy him?
I didn't envy him. I was so carried away by this thing. It was presented with such simplicity, and they were just at music stands, you know, so it was presented in such a way that we were all kind of in it together in that black box theater and just loving this thing together. I wasn't thinking that I would play Aaron Burr ever.
Yeah.
I knew that whoever was going to get to sing Wait For It 8 shows a week was going to be a lucky actor. I knew that.
Yeah.
You know, when he finished that song, I said, wow, that's a song. I've never quite heard a song like that on Broadway. Whoever gets to do that is going to be a lucky guy or girl.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. This is a weird thing to say, but the way that you talk about the show sometimes reminds me of the way that I hear new parents talk about their children.
Yeah.
In terms of like the wonderment of seeing the world with new eyes.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it felt like, or it felt like falling in love. You know, mm-hmm. it felt like that in a lot of ways too.
Can I tell you the two songs that we mentioned earlier, "The Room Where It Happens" and "Wait For It," which are kind of your two big solo moments? The more that I listen to those, the more that those two songs seem like allegories for performance. Maybe it's just something in your voice, the kind of mixture of awe and longing and a kind of lust for the thing that makes you feel like a whole person. And when people are sort of born performers, then that really is what it's like. It's like, you know, vitamin deficiency when you can't do it.
Yeah. That's really well said. And those two things were never lost on me in the creation of this. About the room in which this thing happened, the room that this was created in, it was the most loving, creative, gentle space that I've ever been a part of. And I think that that's one of the reasons why the show looks the way it does and feels the way it does, because nothing was wrong and you could fall flat on your face and you try again tomorrow. It's okay,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so I was singing The Room Where It Happened. I mean, it was very easy for me to connect it to my actual life. And even Wait For It, I remember when I, you know, we would do these readings early on. You know, there was no timeline for me. I was not aware of when Hamilton would happen off Broadway. I was not aware of when it would happen on Broadway.
Uh-huh.
And there's so much rejection that I felt over the past years, that most jobs I do not get, even if I've been a part of the development and stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know, most things move on. So this thing, I was falling in love with it. I loved it more and more. And I didn't know if I was going to end up being the guy. And so over the course of the last 2.5 years or so, it's very tricky, but I had to keep my schedule free,
right,
which meant turning down work, which meant, you know, for no guarantee, you know, but I knew that I sing a song. Every time I do that show, I sing a song called Wait For It.
Right.
And I know what this opportunity could be. So I would sing that song to minister to myself. I would sing that song to, you know, it did feel like it was, you know, meant for me. You know, those messages were meant for me to hear, and now they're meant for me to deliver to somebody else who needs them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Lin has said explicitly a couple of times, he's like, the company is happier when everyone has food to eat. The Room Where It Happens and Wait For It are two of the best songs I've ever written, and I don't get to sing them.
Lin was incredibly generous with this material. And not only Lin, you know, Blankenbuehler and Thomas Kail and, you know, our lighting designer, our costume designer, Paul Tazewell, they wanted everybody to shine. They wanted everybody, when it's your moment, you know, what do you need? Because it's not always about what you're doing when you're in your light. It's not always about clearing space so that you can do something extraordinary. Sometimes the most extraordinary thing you can do is nothing.
Uh-huh.
The most extraordinary thing you can do, the biggest political statement you can make, is to stand there at the center of the stage and be naked and do nothing. Just let us look at ourselves in your eyes. You know, we have the chance in theater. It doesn't always have to be the way it actually is, meaning we can imagine it in a more perfect way,
mm-hmm.
right? We can show what it could look like. This is the potential. This is what friendship and relationships could look like if we wanted them to.
It's the bittersweet thing about theater. I think good theater always feels kind of bittersweet, because if it's been well done, you get a sense of the work behind it and you get a sense of the danger involved in it, but you also feel it ending one moment at a time.
It's true. I mean, but it's the thing that the thing that keeps you coming back, right? I go see the Ailey Company every single year when they're at City Center because, mm-hmm. I mean, nothing inspires me quite like dance. It's just such a pure physical expression. It is, you know, it's distilled even down, you know, farther from what we're doing at the Rogers. It's just pure movement.
Yeah.
And they are superheroes because, you know, that amazing thing, that superhuman feat that I just saw, you did it. There's no wires. There's no special effects. It just happened, you know. So nothing inspires me like that. I go every year.
There's this theme in Hamilton about legacy. And one of the messages of the show is that you don't always have control over that. Do you think about your own legacy? I mean, do you think about, especially in theater where you have the cast album, but it's one of the quirks of theater is that there isn't really a definitive document.
I think about it a little bit. I think about it in this way. Because I am so connected to the people that got me started, you know, the people that helped me, mm-hmm. I am very conscious of how I pass that on. I'm very conscious of how I continue the line, my place in the line. People like Michael McElroy and Billy Porter were angels in my life, really, who gave me early opportunities and gave me early advice. I wouldn't be here without words of encouragement like that, and not to mention the teachers and the stuff that I had coming up in Philadelphia and stuff. So I know that their legacies burn bright in me, you mm-hmm. know, and I talk about them always and I thank them still. So I am very aware and conscious of my responsibility to do that for somebody else. Mm-hmm. It's there, you know, there's, I think that I won't fully understand what we're doing at the Rogers until I have a second away from it, you know, because, I mean, we're still in the middle of it.
Right.
But every now and again, mm-hmm. somebody will come and they'll say something to me about the show or my performance or somebody else's performance in the show that reminds me of what somebody did for me in their performance. You know, that I see that light in their eyes that was in my eyes after I saw a Deaf Poetry Jam or in my eyes after I see Audra May perform or Bilal perform, you know, Lettucey. I mean, I've seen Lettucey do some, you know, things that I'll never forget, you know? And so that is your legacy. You know, your legacy lives in the hearts and the minds of people that see these performances. And so, yeah, I have a little bit of a sense of it now. I might have more of a sense of it after it's all done.
Leslie Odom Jr., thank you so much.
Thank you.